Hello, hello, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Artist Blueprint. My name is John Henry Soto, and as always, I'm here with George Batista, and we have a really, really good show today. We're very excited, and this is something that George and I are passionate about, music. It's our first love, and it'll be our last love, and it's one of the things that brought really George and I, our friendship, and we're family, but our friendship actually really became stronger because of music. And these two artists that you see here, Rush and Stevie Ray Vaughan, there you have Geddy Lee, Alex Lifeson, and Neil Peart in Rush, and of course Stevie Ray Vaughan, and those were the guys that kind of like changed the game in our minds. It did something. Rush pretty much devoured George's brain. We all lost him for a while. He was just devouring the Rush music. And Stevie Ray Vaughan, when I first saw it, I was just mesmerized with everything he did. And that just kept going all the way until we tragically lost him. But today's show is going to be about what is the thing? You know, what is that thing? You know, it's like what I said here, you know, who inspired your music journey, right? And, but what is that thing? You know, what is, you know, it's because there are other rock bands, there are other blues guitar players, you know, and, you know, there's a lot of musicians and artists, and I'm inspired by like so many of them, it's hard to even name them, you know, but what is it about that one artist that just kind of makes your brain and yours and really raises your awareness level to something that you didn't know even was possible and just makes you super happy, you know? And we're going to explore that today with you all, and thank you for being here. If you are watching the show, please let us know who inspired you. If you're a musician or if you're an actor or whatever, any type of art that you are, who was it that inspired you? And that's going to be our conversation. And with me, as always, coming from upper state New York, George Batista. Hello, George.
Hello, sir. I know what I like, and I like what I know.
I don't know what that means. All right. So we have a big show. George is like, and no, I know, and I know I can know, because of no one know it. So let's do our sponsor, because I was just ready to go into this. Let's do our sponsor before anything. So George, take it away.
Yes, sir. All right. So the Counterpart Show is brought to you by not Pfizer. It is. Sorry, I just had to throw that in there. It's brought to you.
The opposite of.
The opposite of Pfizer is brought to you by Wellness Resources, a family-owned and operated nutritional supplement company providing the highest quality clinically formulated supplements since 1985. Find out why they are my favorite supplement company, and they are the favorite supplement company of many people around the world. You can check them out at myvitaminresource.com. If you enter the promo code Artist Blueprint, because you are listeners and viewers of ours, you will get free shipping on your order. Don't forget that. It's Artist Blueprint at checkout. And on top of that, oh, don't forget their monthly specials. Every month they have a great special. This month is Heart Health Month. So, of course, they have 25% off their cardiovascular supplements. Amazing supplements to keep your heart nice and healthy and pumping and blood flowing through it. So, yeah, great, great supplements. I highly recommend them. So check them out. It's Wellness Resources at myvitaminresource.com.
Yep. And no side effects. No side effects. Well, there is one side effect. You'll actually feel really good.
Growing out of my head. No.
Yeah. You'll feel really good. Yes. And creative and have a lot of energy. So if you're totally against that, then do not try these supplements. But if you are for that, then that is what you know, this is the company to get your stuff from.
Agreed.
All right. So George and I are musicians, as some of you might know. If you're first time here watching the show, welcome. And George and I are cousins. We grew up together. We played in a band together called Glass of Know, K-N-O-W, Knowledge. And we were sort of kind of introspective band, right? Had a lot to do with some, not really political stuff, but it had to do with worldly things. And we had a really great time doing that. But we were more obsessed with playing than with anything else. We loved music. We loved playing. We loved artists that were doing something that we found music that you generally would not find in the Bronx, you know, especially where we grew up. You know, I was listening to, I mean, I remember listening to BB King at the Regal on a cassette.
Wow.
You know, when I was a teenager, you know, and I got it, you know, from one of those, Columbia House, you know, 11 for a penny. I remember ordering, you know, and I was like, well, I'll pay them back, you know, and then then after a while they start sending you tapes for like $20 a tape. You're like, oh, I didn't even know. Why did they send this to me? But, yeah, I got from there, I got some, Eric Clapton stuff. I got some, just a lot of music that I knew existed because of WNEW,
yeah,
with Scott Muni.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my radio station, and that's what I would listen to, classic rock, you know. And it wasn't classic rock, it was new.
Yeah,
exactly. I was absorbing all these new artists, and for me, they were new. And Stevie Ray Vaughan was one of those guys. You know, and I remember hearing Texas Flood, and I was like, wow, how is he doing that? You know, because I heard BB King, and BB King is phenomenal. You know, BB King is just well known for, you know, hitting one note and the whole place goes, you know, that's another level of power, right?
Yeah.
And Clapton and those guys, and Santana, who I also was a big fanatic about as well. But there was something that Stevie was doing that was just this uniquely one package spiritual connection of a thing, where there wasn't the man and the guitar. It was just the thing that projected that. You know what I mean? It was like this one entity. And that was like a really, really amazing thing for me. So that was special. That was special.
You know,
hi, Danny. Oh. Sorry, I want to say hi to Danny. Danny Felt.
Hi, Danny.
She's a great singer and a very inspirational person here in Nashville, and does a lot of great things for artists.
Nice.
So Danny Felt, check her out.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah, you know, you think, and artists out there, think about, like John said, think about those folks who have inspired you. But there's always, I always say there's always that one that, I mean, again, we all get inspired by a bunch of folks, right? But there's always that one that was the top of the pyramid, right? And it's funny for me, it was, well, when I was younger, okay, you know, when I was younger, it was the appeal of Kiss for me. Kiss was the big thing for me. And again, they were a big marketing machine and all this, but they were fun to watch. And they had that whole kind of get up and that whole thing.
It was a spectacle.
It was a spectacle. And I loved it. I painted
my face. I mean, for kids, that was, definitely.
Exactly. Yeah. I painted my face. I watched their specials. I bought their albums, Kiss Alive, Kiss Alive 2. I mean, I was really into it. That's how I started banging on drums to Peter Criss's drum. You know, so all that when I was a kid. And again, but for me, when Rush came into my life, it was, the music was the first thing that just blew me away, because I had never heard people play like that before, ever. It just was the first thing.
That progressive rock.
That progressive rock. But not only just progressive rock. There's progressive rock, and then there's the way they did it.
And then there's Rush. Yeah, no, I know.
You know what I mean? Because I'm a big fan of Genesis, too. I love listening to Genesis stuff, and they have some great stuff. And I've been trying to learn some of their more complicated stuff on drums. But they're not Rush. The way Rush did it is just another level. But what I loved about Rush even more when I dove into them as people, I fell in love with the guys.
Yes.
And I think that is what really kind of, you know, put me over, because they were just so cool. They were cool guys who really cared about each other, but also cared about the fan. You know, and there wasn't the ego thing. There wasn't the, you know, the Van Halen, I hate you thing. There wasn't all that stuff. Yeah. They're just three guys.
Yeah. With Rush, I always felt, and I mean, I've never met them. I haven't met, or at least Alex and Geddy, I still love, still time. I still can meet them. I would love to meet them someday. But it was always when they were on stage, you always got the feeling that they were exactly how they are in real life,
right?
On stage, where there wasn't this stage persona that they would put on. They would go out as these amazing musicians who were just, they were just genuine, you know, in their ability to play and connect with an audience. Their musicianship was better than no one. I mean, they were just such a tight group. They had the elements, you know, and this is something that we've talked about in past shows, you know, the perfect storm of a band, you know, where you have all the elements, the Led Zeppelin, Stones, you know, it's just the Beatles. It was just this kind of like a perfect storm of everything that they held filled what was needed in that piece.
Yes.
You know, and these three guys managed to put together, in my opinion, one of the most incredible bodies of work as far as technicality of the music, the spiritualness of music. A lot of people, because Rush is it's a Rush, you know, it's a heavy metal rock band, you know. Mm-hmm. But when you listen to Neil's lyrics, this guy was a philosopher and a half. I mean, this guy was studying life. He was pouring life into his lyrics, you know. And I remember early on listening to it and not even knowing what he was talking about. Right. You know, it wasn't until later that you start kind of growing and start realizing what certain things mean, you know, metaphors and things like that. And it's just inspiring, man.
Agreed. So and the other thing, and kind of going back to talking about Stevie Ray a little bit, I remember when you introduced me to Stevie Ray.
Well, you and I actually saw that together.
The Macambo thing.
Yeah, because I had been hearing Stevie Ray Vaughan on radio, you know, and of course I had some of the music, but I never actually saw him, because remember, this was pre-YouTube, you know, and this was that there was no, I didn't have money to go to a concert if he was in town, you know. And I'll tell you a story about someone I met over the weekend. But, you know, I didn't have money for that. And so for me, it was just if he showed up somewhere on TV, I would see him on TV and maybe on MTV, a music video. Right. You know, you get a glimpse of him at the David Bowie video, you know, Let's Dance. And there's glimpses of him in it because he played on that. Matter of fact, Bowie wanted him to tour with him, and he did some shows, but he didn't want to go on a tour because he wanted to kind of, as he says, I want to do my own thing.
Right.
And you know, so there was a video store, and it was at near George's house called at Castle
Video Castle.
Video Castle. I'm dyslexic. Video Castle, and we went there, and sure enough, I was like, this is that guitar player. I was like, Stevie Ray Vaughan. I was like, I'm still kind of like, have no idea what I'm holding in my hand. You know what I mean? I'm just a guitar player, and I like guitars, and he's great, and I want to hear something. I remember we put it into your VCR. It was at George's house on Chatterton in the Bronx. And I was saying, I was literally like, we both of us were like, like we didn't understand how, what he was doing. I really honestly did not know what he was doing.
Yeah.
I couldn't figure out how his hand was gliding over the strings, but hitting everything single notes and doing this weird gliding thing. I just couldn't figure it out. Then the twirl, and then he played behind his neck and then behind his back. And, yeah. And it was literally the closest thing to a religious experience that you can have musically that I've had was watching Elmo Combo for the first time. And then since then, I've watched it literally hundreds and hundreds of times. I've watched it, and I own it on actually they put it on CD a few years after he passed with some other things that I have and bootlegs. I would literally go downtown to Manhattan. There was a store. It was a record store. There was a record store in Manhattan. Now, this wasn't just a record store. This was like a real record store. You couldn't go in there to buy, you know, Bruce Springsteen's new album. You know what I mean? It wasn't like that. I mean, they probably had it somewhere, but that's not it. You go in there to find like hard to find vinyl and bootleg copies of stuff, either CD or cassette. You know, mainly CDs, because CDs were still fairly new in the early 90s, I guess, you know, around there. So I went and I still own some very, very, very bootleg, not great sounding, but it's him, and it sounds pretty decent, actually, considering, it was probably recorded from, I don't know how they got it, but that was really one of the turning points for me, was not just hearing the studio versions, but hearing him consistently live in other places, seeing what he was doing at different, just different shows, just incredible time that, and then everything just changed for me at that point.
Isn't it amazing though, how those experiences, like you could take it two ways, right? You could, someone can look at those musicians and those artists or whatever and say, I want to be a famous artist, musician, and have that lifestyle. Or you could say, I want to be a great musician like that guy.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think you and I, that's where we always were. Yeah. Right.
I just wanted to get good.
Yes. I wanted to play like Neil. I wanted to play and I was more obsessed with getting good.
Yeah,
that I didn't worry about the rock star stuff. I didn't worry about playing on this. I wanted to just get good. And I wanted to, somebody to be able, who was playing with me in a group to say, wow, that guy can play time. Yeah. He can play some nice fills. That's where I wanted to get.
Yeah. Same. Yeah. It's definitely the same thing. And, playing is like flying, right? We've talked about this before. You know, when you're in that zone, and you're playing, you don't even realize you're playing sometimes anymore. Yeah. You're so in the zone and you're flying, and I wanted to explore that feeling more than anything, because that meant that you were so comfortable with what you were playing that you didn't need the body. And then, you're now operating as a spirit.
Yep.
And you're just controlling it spiritually, and it's no, like, there was no effort. Like you see musicians, when you put too much, I can't get this chord, the frustration then you're not really spiritual anymore. You're not taking it as a spiritual being communicating an art form. You're taking it as a physical body and trying to get your fingers to the, and you're focusing on just the body,
right?
And Rush, and for me, Rush, Stevie Ray, and Stevie Ray Vaughan were both these bands that just operated that way. You watch Geddy Lee playing bass. I mean, do you even notice he's playing bass? But then you hear it and you hear like the most complicated runs.
Yes.
Same thing with Alex. And Alex's guitar playing is like amazing. I know people always say, well, he doesn't get enough credit. No, he gets credit. Yeah. He gets credit. People know he's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Right.
He gets credit. They all get credit. But I can understand, because his playing was not to his playing. It wasn't just for him.
Yes.
He played for Rush.
For the group, so exactly.
He played to the song. And is that, to me, was the most exciting thing.
That's what really separates them in my eyes from so many other groups. Because literally, it was three pieces that fit perfectly that you know, created one thing. But if you take a piece out, you can't just replace that piece. You know,
yeah, you can't have another guitar player.
Fit. Yeah,
or a bass player.
Each one specifically complemented the other.
Yeah.
And it was in a specific way. And the funny thing is, people, you know, again, if people know anything about Rush, Neil Peart wasn't the first drummer, right? There was a drummer before him.
Right.
And the guy, you know, this guy decided to leave and, you know, it just wasn't for him or whatever. They had some conflict or whatever. But when Neil came in and played for Geddy and Alex, and then they sat with him and they spoke with him and had a conversation, they immediately knew this was the guy.
Yeah.
It just clicked.
Geddy tells the story because he's been on a book tour recently, and he tells the story a few times. I've heard him I've watched all the interviews wherever I catch it on YouTube. And one of them, you know, he says basically, you know, he showed up with his drums in garbage bags.
Yeah, yeah.
In green garbage bags, apparently. And he set up, and they're all like, oh, gosh, skinny, tall, skinny, lanky guy shows up. And then he starts doing these runs and these paradiddles and these fills. And Geddy was like, already, he's the guy.
Yeah.
But Alex was sort of like, we promised the other guys that we were going to listen to, you know, you can't, you know, he was kind of like giving Geddy the evil eye because he was like, no, we have to listen to everybody, you know. But then after, at the end of that, it was like, yeah, we could listen to anybody. But Geddy was like, I'm not letting this guy out of my sight. You know? And yeah, that was the beginning of it. You know, I think also their humor was equally the same. You know, Alex being a very, very funny guy, probably the funniest of the bunch, and you know, but also Neil being, you know, so intellectual and very well read, but still being able to laugh so hard at Alex's, you know, silliness, you know, was just. And then, you know, Geddy is somewhere in between. He's intellectual. He's also silly.
Yep.
He's also a philosopher in his own right, you know, when you're speaking. And even Alex, I've been listening to Alex interviews a lot in the last couple of months because he's been playing, what's that group that he plays with now? He just put a new album out. It's really good stuff. It's very Enya kind of stuff. But, you know, he's been on some interviews and stuff, and he's been talking about how, you know, the band's experience and what he's going through. And he also has his own, you could see why they got together and why they actually all fit perfectly. You know, it just made sense for those guys to be, you know, doing what they did for 40 years, you know, we have to tell the story of George and I first Rush concert because we've told it before, but we are talking about Rush, and then we'll talk a little bit more about Stevie in a little bit. But so our first Rush concert, we get to go see Rush. This is late 80s.
Let's talk about how we got there, by the way.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm going to start.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, so
we get tickets to go see them, late 80s, I believe it was.
It was actually 90.
Oh, was it 90?
It was probably 90 or 91.
Really? That late?
Yeah, it was the Roll the Bones tour.
Yeah, I know it was the Roll the Bones tour. I know Mr. Big opened for them.
Yes, correct.
At Jones Beach.
Jones Beach.
And so we get our tickets. George had three tickets. Right. And we were trying to find somebody that didn't want to come or something happened. Yeah, we had
my ex-girlfriend at the time who last minute said no.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why she's the ex-girlfriend. Yeah,
exactly.
So we had these three tickets, and so we had the tickets. I had the tickets in this. I had this blue bag that I would carry. I always carry like a bag with like my crap in it. So I had a little blue bag and I had the tickets in there. So we get there. We George had this orange Chevette car
that was my first that car
that had a lawnmower engine in it, and it had a hole in the front seat where I sat and the passenger side front.
The floor of the passenger side had rust, because remember, this is, I bought this car, I think, for $500 off of a family member. And I mean, this car had rust all over. It was really in bad shape. And it had, you know, you're broke. I'm a broke college student, you know, at the time. So it had the floor of the passenger side had rusted through. So there was a hole.
So if you could look down, you just see the road.
Right. Basically. It was like the Flintstones, you know. So yeah. the heat would come up through the
heat from the engine would come up through there. So I had to sit there, you know. I was, and of course, I'm also not a big guy. I could fall through right through there. You know, I was like nervous about that. So I would have to put my feet on the dashboard. This is how we had to drive all the way to Connecticut? No, it's not Connecticut.
No, it was Jones Beach, Long Island.
Jones Beach, Long Island. So we had to, with my feet up on the dashboard, basically the whole way, because the heat was coming up so, it was so freaking hot.
And no that GPS literally back then. It was all maps.
Oh, yeah. We also, another thing, we had no GPS. It was sort of like, yeah, I think you got to take it.
Yeah.
Looking at the map.
Like, oh, the sign, you know.
Yeah. There was their signs. I don't know if people even know their signs anymore. But yeah, so we get to, after an hour and something drive up to Long Island, we get there. And when you're going into the parking lot, you have to just show that you have tickets to get in. And this was back in the days, which was, you know, pre all the stuff that have happened, right? Pre 9/11, pre even 93, where things happened at the World Trade Center. So it's pre all of that stuff. Things were safe. So you can literally just show your tickets and they'll let you right into the parking lot. So we get into the parking lot. I had the bag like this and I left the bag open. So I don't remember leaving the bag open. I just know that I showed the guy the tickets and he looked and he's like, all right, go ahead, go. So we went in. I get out of the car and I still have my bag with me. I don't know why I had my bag, but I guess I was taking my bag in with me. It was like a security blanket. So I had my bag and stuff. And when we're standing online, I go to get my bag and there's no tickets in the bag.
Now, keep in mind, there is a long walk from when you leave the parking lot all the way through. It's like a long trail. I mean, literally like a 10-minute walk all the way through to when you get to the actual gate before you get let into the theater. Yeah. So we get to the gate and they have to scan the ticket or whatever at the gate itself. And that's where we realize nothing there.
So my heart is basically gone. This is our first time seeing Rush. We've been following Rush. George has been a fanatic way more than me. I mean, George went on a whole other level of loving them. And he's a drummer, so he was really involved in playing the music. And my heart was broken. I couldn't breathe. I almost blacked out. I mean, I was so horrified.
And that was because horrified. I was choking him.
Yeah. I was like, I'm good. So we start running back to the car. I'm looking everywhere. We get to the car. We're looking around the car. We open the car up. We're looking in the car. The hole. Because it falls through the hole. So I'm looking in the car and stuff. And some angel dude comes up and he's like, hey, you guys lost some tickets? And I was like, yeah, we had 3 tickets. He was like, here they are.
Wow.
Did we give him one because we only needed 2?
No, he didn't need it.
He didn't need it, right? I was like, oh, I think I offered it. I was like, we have an extra one. I don't know if you guys want it. And he was like, no, we're good, man. I was like, all right, thank you. So we found the tickets. And I mean, till this day, George still makes the joke. And for that moment on, remember, we're pretty young. I mean, I'm not young, but early, I guess early. I was in my early 20s. And you probably were.
I was my late teens.
Late teens, probably, yeah. And and my heart is like just racing. I don't, you know. So I finally come to. And we go in to see Rush. And we had really good seats, right?
Yeah, we were on the floor level.
On the floor level, like I was really surprised at how good we did pay. Like
it had rained that day too, so everything was kind of wet.
Yeah. So and yeah, because the Jones Beach Theater, for those who don't know, it's an outdoor venue, and the first band was
Mr. Big.
Mr. Big, which they're on tour right now, as a matter of fact, on their final tour, their goodbye tour. And Billy Sheehan, who actually I got to meet many, many times actually since then, great legendary bass player. So at the time when I first, you know, saw them, we didn't know who Mr. Big was. Mm-hmm. We just wanted to see Rush.
Yes.
You know, and then this bass player came out and did the most amazing guitar, you know, bass solo, which I never even saw a bass solo. Right. And I thought to myself, I was like, wow, this guy is really brave to do a bass solo when Geddy Lee is in the house and just about ready to take the stage.
I know.
With freaking Rush, you know. But of course, Billy Sheehan is a legend, actually. Yeah. You know, legendary bass player. He was a legend even back then when we first saw him. And then the moment came.
Do you remember what happened to my program?
Yeah, I was gonna mention that. So they give you these programs, you know, and you get to read the program and all that stuff. So George was so the intensity was just so driven. He was like, and then Rush finally comes, takes the stage, and through the whole show, he's like, and we're like, you know, screaming. And then by the end of it, it was basically just pulverized dust.
It was like this thin and dust.
Completely crushed. It was so hilarious.
But it was one of the most amazing experiences. I mean,
we left there literally.
Nobody sat. Everybody was up. Everybody just.
Yeah, and everybody was standing. Yeah, there was no. Matter of fact, most Rush shows, there's really no.
Yeah, people
sitting.
People don't
who
stand.
Sits? And, so you know, who's going to sit at a Rush show?
I mean, that's what I learned in our first one. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, nobody sits at a Rush show. I can't even imagine.
But holy cow, that was. And
it was life changing.
It was life changing. And if you think about it, it was. Amazing that we got there. It was amazing that, you know, it was just amazing the whole day and how we got those tickets back. Because, you know, think about this. Think about if it was 10 minutes later and the guy had walked.
Yeah.
And we pass him. Well, he doesn't know.
And I will say something also about Rush fans. Rush fans are different. I know people are going to say, you know, I don't want to name any other bands, but if we were out to see some other band, maybe there's a lot of them that I can name that I won't name just out of respect to band members, you know, but they're bands that are different. But Rush fans are committed. They're loyal. They're just super nice people, mostly males from age of, you know, at that point, age, you know, 18 to maybe, you know, 40, 45 at that point. You know, at that time, now it's from like, because there's still a lot of young people listening to Rush today. So, you know, till now there's 70 and 75 year olds going to see Rush, you know, or towards the end of their run. But the fans are really loyal. They're really, really loyal. And so the fact that we got our tickets back was more likely that it would have happened at a Rush concert had we been some other concert with fans that are a little bit different, not to make fun of any, and it's not even making fun, it's actually stating a fact that Rush fans are extremely loyal.
Yeah,
this is why you had a band that for 40 years would fill up a stadium, but you never heard them barely on the radio except for their classics, you know, Tom Sawyer and Spirit of Radio you know, what's the other one? Owners of a Lonely Heart. No, yes. Communication breakdown. Funny, we named two Led Zeppelin songs, but when they first came out with Working Man that played in Chicago was a big thing. People were calling up the radio station saying, hey, when did the new Led Zeppelin record come out?
Yes, that's right.
That's not Led Zeppelin. That is a band out of Canada called Rush. And so that was pretty cool. But so Rush fans are very loyal, and that was our experience, our first concert to see Rush. And then since then, we went almost every time they came.
Yeah.
George went almost every single time they came.
Yeah.
I try to go almost every time, and every show was incredible. Every show blew my mind. They were tight. They were funny. They were engaging. It just felt like a really great time. And the audience was always so mesmerized, right?
Yes.
Like, you wouldn't get like a lot of screaming, a lot of guy, you know, mosh pit and that kind of thing. You know, it wasn't that kind of, it wasn't that kind of a band. It was sort of like they just wanted to see the performance. And there were a lot of musicians go see Rush.
Of course.
A lot of drummers. You see them in the, you know, in the audience.
They're all doing this, right?
They're all air drumming, you know? So, you know, I just kind of love that experience that we had and really treasure those moments. Because I really do feel that that band had really, they really cared about what they were doing. You know, yes. They really, really put in the work. They cared. And we talked about this even early before we came on the air. George and I were talking about bands, you know, and being in a band and how, you know, you have to be 100%. Every single member has to be 100% committed to what the mission is, to what the purpose is. You need to have an actual goal, and then you have to be committed to that one goal.
Right.
And one of the things that you know we learned, or that I've learned, is that you really can't have a 90% person in, because 90% is a good, it's a passing grade in most schools, but 90% is not good enough if you're trying to have a mission, because it just shows that someone is 10% out,
right?
You know, and you can't be successful if you're 10% out. You have to be all 100% in. And it has to be a unit. And we talked about the group, right? The perfect storm, right? The Rush and the Beatles. I don't know if we talked about this on the show or off the show, but George and I kind of we talk like this all day.
The show before the show.
But the Beatles, perfect storm, you know, everyone contributed exactly what was needed for that recipe. Led Zeppelin, exactly. The Stones, exactly. You know, it was like that kind of thing. And I think that's something that you can see. The Who, I'll have to say The Who, because, you know, those guys were super committed to the mission early on, even though Pete Townsend was the mastermind behind everything. He wrote everything.
Right.
You know, Roger Daltrey just projected it. You know, he sang everything, but it was Pete that really put everything together, but he needed Roger,
right?
Correct. You know what I mean? He needed Roger, he needed Moon. You know, it was like those guys just really gelled into something that was incredibly different, unique, you know. So that's important.
Yeah, one thing that Rush never fell into, which a lot of other bands do fall into, and it's not necessarily a band thing, sometimes it's just a musician thing, is where one of the members says, it could be the lead singer, or say, you know, it happens now more than before, but it's like, I need to go on my own. I can't be doing this anymore, you know, or maybe they'll do their solo thing. And then eventually it's like, no, like Rush, even like when Rush had hiatus, Geddy Lee did his own he did his album. Alex Lifeson did an album.
There was always Rush.
Yeah. But then it was like, okay, let's get back to work.
Yeah,
on what Rush is. I mean, they could till this day, they could have still been, if Neil Peart hadn't passed away, they would have still been playing, and they would have still been Rush.
Yeah.
And no matter what, because they, and I think in their minds, they knew that they cannot replace any one of these people.
No.
You know, they knew that. They knew in their heart of hearts that they couldn't, if one leaves, the band is done.
It's done,
So,
well, I was listening to an interview with Geddy and Alex, and they did, you know, they asked him, is there any chance that, and you guys are still able to play, is there any chance that you can go out and grab one of these legendary drummers and do and go out on a tour? And they both said, nothing is off the table.
Right.
Nothing is, but Rush, as we know it, is done.
Yeah.
Rush is done. Now that would be more of a tribute.
Correct.
Maybe to Neil, and I would say that would probably be a really great tribute, you know, to go out and get, you know, you can go out and get three of these amazing drummers that are out there. We can name them all, you know, George can name them all. And they'll you know, the guy from Dream Theater,
Portnoy.
Portnoy, yeah. He's playing with Billy Sheehan, actually, in Winery Dogs right now.
Yep.
And he is phenomenal. You know, I mean, and there are guys like that that can do that and do a tribute tour to the legacy that was Neil, because Neil is a powerhouse. You know what I mean? He's not only was he an amazing drummer, but he was also an author. He wrote books. He was also a poet. He wrote poetry books. He wrote every lyric. He did go through some heartaches in his life as well, you know, losing his daughter and then a year later his wife. And still was able to persevere. As a matter of fact, George and I were at the show, their first show back.
Yeah.
After that whole tragedy.
Yeah.
We were at that show. And one of the most emotional things that I can remember was when they started playing, that they looked at each other.
And they
kind of were like,
we're okay. Yeah. We're okay. We're here. You know,
we're doing it.
And that's, you know,
and it just chokes me up even now thinking about it.
Yeah. Because again, you know, somebody in your band went through this and you give them the time and the space that they need. And they gave them, they were out for 5 years.
I know. And you just didn't know. What are you going to say? You know, you couldn't blame Neil for never coming back.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? And it was like, you know. the testament to their, who they are as people.
Exactly.
You know, it's just wonderful. And I really hope that their music, not only their music will go on, obviously, but also that it picks up another form, like either in a musical or a concept show of some type of video or something, because 2112 in itself is an epic story.
Yes.
You know, I mean, you can have a whole series based around just that album alone, you know, and every single album really has it just flows so well that can be really you know, it can become a show, really, you know. And that'd be epic.
Agreed. I want to kind of pivot to Stevie Ray for a second, because again, talking about how we watched Stevie Ray together, and again, it's interesting how John and I, because John likes drummers. John, you know, even though he's an amazing guitar player, but he loves to watch drummers play.
I love drummers. I watch them on YouTube. And I'm a drummer, right?
Right, exactly. And I'm a drummer, but yet I'm fascinated. I learned how to play. John taught me my first chords on guitar. And I kind of took it from there and started to play. I learned bar chords. I learned a lot of stuff where I can play, you know, decent rhythm guitar here and there, you know. But I love playing guitar. It's one of my favorite things to do. And it's just a great thing to be able to play a song to relieve stress and all this. But I love to watch guitar players as well. So it's interesting how we have that thing.
Yeah, it's true.
But Stevie Ray, I still haven't seen it in my, you know, and John sees more guitar players than I do. But the combination of rhythm, of being melodic, and speed, you know, because there are guitar players that are melodic, but they're just very melodic, right? A lot of blues players could be very melodic. And then there's the Van Halen type of speed guys that are just kind of all over the place, you know, and hammer-ons and all this. But he had this amazing ability to be so melodic and fast at the same time, where his notes were so rhythmic within the music that just blew me away. And to this day, I still watch videos of him.
Yeah.
And I am floored how he had that ability to do that. And again, as a novice guitar player, I don't know half as much as John does, but just by my musical, just watching him, unbelievable. I still haven't seen that. The ability that he did it.
No, I haven't seen it either, and I have watched a lot of guitar players, and there are some incredible guitar players out there that I love, and there was something unique about Stevie, and Eric Clapton talked about it, and Eric said, I think he said it best, because he was kind of like talking about how there was never a, and I talked about this the other, I'll tell you my weekend story. Actually, I'll tell you that one first, and then I'll go into the about Eric Clapton said. But like over the weekend, my son had one of his friends' birthday party, so I took him there and stuff. And I was talking to the dad of the birthday boy, and big Stevie Ray Vaughan fan, huge Stevie Ray Vaughan fan. So we of course we hit it off, right. And we're just chatting, and his dad named him Jimmy, from Jimi Hendrix. He's also a big. So his dad is a huge music fan. So his dad is a huge Stevie Ray Vaughan fan. So his dad comes out and we start chatting Stevie Ray Vaughan. His dad saw Stevie Ray Vaughan 32 times.
Holy God.
I never saw him once. Wow. He was gone before I had I just didn't go see him. 32 times, and he told me some great stories, and we could have gone on. He was like, he had to go in the house for a second, and he was like, I'll be back. I could talk all day. And I was like, I can hear all day. So he had some great stories, but we were talking about Stevie. And matter of fact, our late guitar player for our band Glass of No, David and I once were driving to wherever we were driving to a gig or to a rehearsal. And We start saying like, who's your favorite artist of all time? Like, who's our, and we're both kind of like the favorite artist. Like, yeah, not a band, not a, you know, just like artist, overall artist, you know, like just, and we both were like Stevie Ray Vaughan. And he said, dude, I was like, really? He was like, no. And he was like, yeah, Stevie. I was like, are you serious? He was like, yeah. And so we were like, we totally understood that there was this other element of this unique ability to be one with the instrument, as corny and cheesy as that sounds. He never, and what Eric Clapton said was that he never saw Stevie go into a solo, like, you know, like be and then now, okay, here comes the solo. I'm in.
Right.
Where, you know, Clapton says, you know, I gotta think. I have to go. Yeah. I'm playing my chords, and now here comes the solo. Now I have to think, and I'm going into my solo. That was never a thing for Stevie. Stevie was always in the thing, and it was like the solo would just come when the solo. Everything was just this one unit of a musician, and I still to this day say, you know, and I've been saying this for since then, that he to me was that complete artist.
Yeah.
You know, where he had the ability to make the instrument. He had great vocals too. Yes. I don't think, you know, people talk about his vocals as much. But he had great vocal, strong vocals, and he was able to complement his voice melodically with the guitar, you know, and also single. I mean, I don't want to get into technical stuff, but he also played really heavy strings.
Yeah.
Like very, very heavy strings. And his guitar was actually a body. The body was a standard Strat, you know, it was like a 57, I think. But then the neck, he had the neck replaced to a 62. Wow. And a 62 is a little thicker neck. And then he had the coils on his pickups completely rewounded for him. So his instrument was basically, he called it the number one. His number one was basic. And you can buy, you know, pretty much a close replica now. You know, I saw one the other day somewhere for like, I think it was like $54,000 or something. It's a replica, but it's an exact replica of what, you know, what he has and stuff, or what he had. And so his guitar was very unique. It wasn't like you could play it either. You know, it wasn't like I could pick up his guitar and play it because the strings were really heavy.
Mm-hmm.
He dug in there. I mean, he would bend a string two notes up. And he was playing like thick, you know, like 13s and stuff like that, which are heavy, like B.B. King and stuff is famous for saying, you know, telling I can't remember who he told, but he told another young guitar player, you know, or maybe it was Buddy Guy. One of those guys was saying, you know, he uses light strings, you know, and the guy said, well, don't you have to use heavy strings? He goes, no, why work so hard? You know, it's like, you know, and so they use light strings. By light, we mean like a really light gauge is like eights, like an eight is like the E string is an eight.
Right.
Eight or nine. Like I use nines, you know, nines are good. I've used a 10 before. Tens are good also, but I like nines and stuff. I haven't really tried eights as much, but I do like nines. So he was at 13.
Wow.
You know, and then he had it. He was tuned. Now he was tuned half a step down.
Okay.
He was tuned half a step down, like Hendrix was, right. And so was Van Halen. Mm-hmm. That's why a lot of people, if you hear Stevie Ray Vaughan song on the radio and you pick up your guitar thinking you're going to play with it and you're tuned in standard, you're not going to be able to play with it, you know. And that kind of gets people frustrated a little bit.
Yes.
But they tune half a step down. Yeah. So the fact that he did tune half a step down made the strings a little bit more bearable, you know, even though they were 13s, it was still easier for him to dig into them and stuff. But he had this unique ability to be full connected with those notes, with those strings, in, you know, no matter where his hand was coming from, whether it was whatever, that one note he was hitting.
I don't understand.
Yeah. And, you know, as the years gone on, not that I can, that I'm nowhere near what he was doing, but I get it now. And I spent decades literally trying to do that. And there are moments where I can, when I'm playing, is now that I'm playing more consistently with the band, I can get into a place where I can feel what that feels like, what that must have felt like. Now, he was just constantly, that was his world where he lived in.
Yeah.
Right? He lived in that upper aesthetic wavelength that we talk about on the show sometimes, and it's just upper level of beauty and creativity and peace and spirituality. He lived in that realm all the time when he was playing. You know, there was never this thing like, "I gotta get up there, I gotta go." You know, I never heard anyone say he didn't sound good.
No, I know exactly.
I mean, think about that. There are a lot of guitar players. I mean, you and I have saw. I saw once Eric Clapton,
yes,
make a mistake on stage, yes, live, mm-hmm, while we were there at the Garden.
Yep.
You know, and he kind of just laughed.
Yep.
You know, he's Eric Clapton. He can do whatever he wants. You know, and you know what I mean. But we were like, you know, human. You know what I mean. But I never saw a bad performance, or I never heard of a bad performance. I never saw a video. I never heard any live stuff. You know, the album Alive Alive, which people, Alive Alive, people actually say that was not a great recording. Mm. It was, and I kind of agree with some of the, I think the recording methods were not fantastic. It's not one of my favorites, but the playing was still phenomenal.
Yes.
You know, I mean, the playing, yes, was still great. You know, he did one at Carnegie Hall where he was live. Amazing show. Mm-hmm. One of his last Austin City Limits,
yeah,
where he really just shined. And
yeah,
you know, when we watch El Mocambo originally, you know, he was still on drugs, you know, he was heavy, you know, he was a heavy drug case, and he cleaned up for the album In Step, right. And in the album there's a lot of, you know, actually the song Crossroads is about that, you know, Tightrope, you know, these songs are all about that kind of the house is a rockin', you know, those kind of songs are a clean person now, you know, he's kind of coming out of this dark phase and stuff. But the Mocambo was at the height, you know, he was really, really messed up on drugs. He played incredible, like I said before, like I've never seen anything like it. And then his last Austin City Limits, he was so clear-eyed. You know, his eyes were, he looked at the audience. If you look at El Mocambo and you look at Austin City Limits, you'll see that one of the things that the difference is his eyes.
I remember when you pointed that out to me.
Yeah, yeah. El Mocambo, he was always, his eyes were closed. He really wasn't confronting the audience. Again, he's, you know, the spirit is taken over. He's kind of just playing he's just in that zone. Like I said before, he's at a level that just people just don't normally live there. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's just, he was just consistently there. So it didn't matter what he was putting in his body. Unfortunately, or fortunately, because he did get off of drugs and he did become clean and, you know, he was taken from us tragically in a helicopter accident on August 27th, 1990. And, you know, that was a day that really sucked, yeah. You know, so, and then in Austin City Limits, he's looking at the audience.
Yeah.
He's smiling. Mm-hmm. He's making kind of like jokes and stuff. Like at one point he kind of stops and he goes, and everybody just laughs and stuff because he's just like right between songs and stuff. He played. But now if anybody wants to hear him soar in a way that you're just amazing, go to YouTube, go to the Austin City Limits, Stevie Ray Vaughan, and the song is Tightrope. Mm. Go to Tightrope and go to the second solo. The second solo on that is at a level that is beautifully crafted. It's melodic. There's speed there. Speed is not a thing. You know what I mean? Speed is fine. You know, I feel like after Van Halen, because Van Halen was changed the game for guitar as well. You know, Van Halen did something that no one else was doing, and he made the instrument. Remember, Van Halen also didn't have any pedals.
Right.
He didn't have any. He had a guitar and he had an amp. And he had the amp, everything tuned in a place that nobody could even play it.
Right.
You know, his guitar. He did something that was uniquely him. You know what I mean? Stevie, on the other hand, did something where he combined this melodic ability to play with speed, because he can play as fast as anybody, with finesse.
Correct.
You know, finesse. Correct. And of course, Van Halen missed a finesse too. You know what I mean? But it's two different types of styles anyway. So it's
Because when I say speed, and I just want to, and again, it's not speed for the sake of speed. Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, speed with it, I call it, and I guess it's just the way I look at it, like it's like melodic speed, I guess I can call it. There's a melody within it. If you're playing it's a beautiful, but it's melodic, but it's fast within the bar, right? But it's, you know, but it's so melodic, and it's, I don't see a lot of guys playing that way. You know, I mean, again, there's great guitar players out there.
They're great guitar players, you know,
but not with the finesse.
Yeah.
That, like, you, and I think that you put it perfectly. The finesse that he did it in is just
He combined all those elements, you know, because there's guys. I mean, I'm in Nashville, right? So, I mean, there's guitar players here that are just unbelievable, you know. Right. I mean, I'll go somewhere and I went over the weekend, I went over to Papa Turney's, which is a little barbecue joint right by 2 minutes from my house here. By the water. So I go there every once in a while to get a dinner. And I just went in by myself just to see freaking kid up there, you know, playing guitar. Amazing. Very, very, very good guitar player. You know what I mean? So we have tremendous guitar players here.
Yeah.
You know, again, there's a full package of something.
Yeah.
You know, that, you know, when people say he's got it.
Yes.
You know, well, Stevie was born with it.
Yes, he was.
You know, and a lot of other people, they study it,
right,
and they do get it,
mm-hmm,
but he was sort of like it.
You're right. He was absolutely gifted. The way he was able to access that, just completely, again, it's like those young people who play amazing things. They're just completely gifted. They have it, right? That light just shines and boom, they can do it. And they can do it effortlessly.
Yeah.
Right. It's I've always said, if you can do something effortlessly and you don't really have to practice, and you could just somehow do it, you have that. You were born with that. That's a gift. And if you are able to harness that and build off of that, you can do amazing things.
Yeah. I also want to validate also his brother, Jimmy Vaughan, who was in the Thunderbirds, Fabulous Thunderbirds, and a great band also, and a great guitar player himself.
Yeah.
But I also want to validate him because he's really kept his brother's legacy alive, mm-hmm, by putting out new music, by doing tributes to him, albums, and really just understanding that his little brother was something else.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
You know, there was never any jealousy.
Right.
You know, matter of fact, they have an album that they did together.
You know, that's right.
It's called Family something. Brothers or Family. I can't remember. Yeah. But there was a song in there called TikTok, which is a really great song. The whole album is really, really fun. It's two brothers, just the love of music and just doing it, you know. And so when you know, I just want to mention Jimmy because, you know, that it takes a lot to be the older brother, but then see your little brother, you know, excel at the instrument that you started on. Yeah. And you influenced your brother, but that the love was so big that he was like, go, man, go, little brother, do it, do it, do it, you know, and that was really a great thing. So, and we still have, you know, there's still music. I don't know what else is recorded, but, you know, from what I've heard through the grapevine, and I do follow a lot about what's going on in the Stevie camp. Mm-hmm. And there's stuff still that was recorded, and there, you know, there's still stuff that we will get to hear. You know, I don't know how much of it is out there, but every time something comes, or even if I'm on YouTube and stuff, we're at the top of the hour now, folks, so thank you for hanging out. But even if I go to YouTube and I see a clip that I never saw before, yo, I get like my hair, like I'm like, even if it's just an interview,
yeah,
you know, even just an interview, like when I first went on YouTube and I saw there was a sound check. It was just a sound check. There's nobody in the audience. He was playing this big place, and he just walked on stage and he's doing a sound check, and he played, I don't know, he played like for like 10 minutes or something, you know, like on a sound check. And it was like, I was like just tearing. I was like, oh my God, who had this video, you know? So just YouTube is, you know, a blessing for that reason. Yeah. You know,
I find a lot of those stuff, and I mean more stuff that I haven't seen. I mean, you've seen it, but I haven't seen that. I'm like, oh, and sometimes I'll send it to John, have you seen this? Yeah, he was playing with Omar Hakim, he was playing with this one, he was playing with that, you know, that I didn't even know he played with, even if it was just one gig.
Yeah. Well, here's something awesome. I did not even know this. This was, and I wish I had more time to talk to him, but the gentleman that I met over the weekend was telling that he saw Stevie 32 times. He was telling me he was at a show. And it was this big giant show. It was like, I think it was Lincoln Center or something. Mm. And the person that opened for the whole show, it was like this big event. And it had, I can't remember specifically of what it was, but it was this big event. And Stevie was closing out the night. You know, he was the closing out. But then the person that opened the event was Benny Goodman.
Really?
And I said to him, wait, not the Benny Goodman. You mean like Benny Goodman Jr., like his son? He's like, no, Benny Goodman, and he was like 80 or something, and he opened the show. And so then I thought to myself, what a trivia that Stevie Ray Vaughan Benny Goodman actually linked in some way, where you had a guy who's hugely famous in the 40s, in the 30s and 40s and 50s, and on his whole career, Benny Goodman was like a legend, you know. But then all the way up to to Stevie Ray and performing on the same bill. And I thought, wow. I was like, what? And the guy was at this show. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite CDs was recorded in Philly. And it was the CD, it was on a Cobra Records. It wasn't anything that you can buy now. So sorry, it was like sort of a bootleg. It wasn't really a bootleg because it was put out by Cobra Records, but Cobra Records, I think, went under. And Stevie was in a band called the Cobras for a little while. So I don't know if that came from that, but anyway, I bought this this thing somewhere in Manhattan, and it was my favorite till this day, my favorite live performance of ever. So I'm telling him about this the CD that I have, and he's like, "I was at that show."
Oh my God!
He was at that show in Philly. I was like, "No, no, no!" And I gave him the album cover. I was like, "No, it's the one where he's got the Indian feathers and the pipe and stuff," and he's like on the side. He goes, "Yeah, I know Philly," and he named the whole thing of when it was. He was like, "Yeah, I was at that show," and I was like, "Oh my God!" I was like, "Dude, you're killing me!" And he was just laughing. I was like, "Wow." So
yeah, and on top of that, I just want to kind of also just mention that his band, you know, Chris Layton and all these guys, you know,
Reese Lyons.
Yeah, you know, rock solid group, you know, because again, to play that music, you know, that music is deceptively difficult to play. Yeah. You have to live in that space for years to be able to really effectively play that type of music.
And be able to understand that you're behind. He's sort of like Jimi Hendrix in the Experience.
Yes.
You know, was Nolan Redding and
Redding, yeah.
And I can't remember the Mitch Mitchell. You know, those guys had to do kind of the same thing. You know, they're behind some force.
Yep.
And all they're doing is they're trying to keep up.
Exactly.
You know, Chris Layton, you can see it in his face. He's just trying to keep up with this. You know, I mean, he's keeping up great. You know, now don't get me wrong, but I mean, just trying to hang tight. And Tommy Shannon was just always very chilled out bass player, very chilled out bass player. And Reese, legend. You know, Reese is a legend. And now Reese is playing with Joe Bonamassa. And I saw Reese Wines live with Joe Bonamassa. I was in the front row. And the show starts with Reese getting on the keyboard. He's like,
amazing.
He comes out. And Joe Bonamassa, just to give him a shout out, he's a great guitar player. Mm-hmm. Great guitar player. I'm a huge fan of
playing close to here not long ago.
Yeah. He's one of those guys that I respect tremendously because he's self-made.
Mm.
Like, he didn't record companies. His company is him.
Is him, yeah.
Everything comes in is him. His market is him. Everything he does is him. Wow. You know, he's got no responsibility. You know, he could do whatever he wants. He could do whatever he wants, you know, and that's like really empowering, you know, like, and he built that, you know, and he was a member. Joe was a child prodigy. He got to open for B.B. King when he was 12. You know, so he's a, you know, he came in that stage when there was, it was him, it was Billy, Joe Bonamassa, I keep saying Billy, Joe Bonamassa, it was Derek Trucks,
right,
who started with the Allman Brothers when he was like 12. Right. They're the same age, both those guys. And it was John Mayer kind of like hit the big time around 19 years old, but he had already a following, right, like in the community and stuff. But, you know, 18, 19, so he was kind of a, you know, and there were these young guys, you know, those are the guys that are going to carry us to the next. And I like those guys because they're so committed to the legends. They know what they're representing and they bring it forward with respect,
exactly,
you know, and I love that. And those are the guys that I really follow. There's a new guy called Matteo Macuso, which I don't know if you've seen him before, but
I don't think I've seen
him. He's an Italian. He's 26 years old, and he has this finger style technique that's sort of like Mark Knopfler, kind of with his fingers, classical style. Another level of something. It's just a different thing. It's just a different thing. You know what I mean? The runs are as fast as like Eric Johnson.
Oh wow!
Speed, you know, like that on crack or on what's the speed or something?
Yeah.
He's incredible. So he's 26. So there's Kenny Wayne Shepherd. There's Johnny Lang. These are all young cats, you know, that are out there. There's a kid that I met here. He goes by the name of Singa B, and I met him at Papa Turney's. He was playing. I was like, 10 people in the place. This guy is phenomenal, but he's actually now really doing really well. And he's originally from Memphis and stuff. And on Saturday, when I was at this event for Black History Month, one of the panelists mentioned Singa B. And I was like, because he says he's one of the young guys that are sort of like keeping the world, you know, of the blues alive,
right,
with an understanding where it's coming from and bringing the respect to it. You know, he's not as young. I think he's 30, 31 or something like that. Still a young guy. And so I went up to talk to, his name is Lorenzo Washington. And I went up to talk to him and I told him I met Singa B, and he was like, oh my God, you met that guy, man. And Lorenzo is he's 81 years old. He operates the Jefferson. I could do a whole show on that.
Wow.
On what he's doing. As a matter of fact, I want to ask him to be on the show because this guy is the guy. I mean, he told me things that we're going to go off topic a little bit here, but yeah. And if you're still hanging out, thank you. I love you. But Jefferson Street here in Nashville, for those who don't know, was the spot for the blues.
Really?
The spot for the blues. It was part of what they call the Chitlin circuit. And all these blues artists, B.B. King, Buddy Guy, Muddy Water, you know, Muddy Waters. All these guys would come through, and they'd come to Nashville. And Nashville on Jefferson Street had all these blues clubs, and it was in tremendous blues place. And what happened was, what had to happen was that Nashville didn't want to invest money in promoting the blues because they didn't want to take this is what they were saying. This is what Lorenzo said. I believe him because he was there. Right. But they didn't want to promote the blues because they didn't want any attention taken away from country music.
I could see that.
Really part of the framework of here, you know. So what they did was they went to Memphis. This is why Memphis had Stax Records, which launched the careers of all those incredible blues artists and stuff. But Jefferson Street is still here, and he has now the Jefferson Street Sound Museum, and he shows all the artifacts. He shows all the place, and he created this thing. I'm telling the whole story now. He created this thing. It's a tree, basically, and this tree he created, it has like Jefferson Street is in the middle, and then it branches off to all the clubs, and then on all the clubs, all the artists that played there. So it's this beautiful thing that he developed, you know, and so it's this really great thing. But the blues was so much the fabric here of Nashville, and it's still now, you know, there's a lot of venues now where you can listen to any kind of music here. This is Music City. It's not just country music, you know. Broadway is more of a tourist attraction place, but if you go to other, there's great venues like Third and Lindsay and the Ryman. There's these great clubs here that the Ryman is a pretty big 2,000 seater. Third and Lindsay is a smaller place, maybe like, I don't know, 500, maybe to 1,000 or something. But you can hear these incredible blues artists, you know, there and stuff, and not a lot of money. Like, I literally have seen the most incredible music here for $20. For $20, you know, where, you know, you can pay $10,000 to see Taylor Swift. I like Taylor Swift. I'm not saying anything about Taylor Swift, but I'm saying, you know, whatever she created something incredible. Whether people like her or not, that's not my thing. I don't go around listening to all her music and stuff, but just as an entity, what she did was pretty amazing, you know. But I like to sit, and George could tell you stories when we would go to the Bottom Line, New York City, and we're sitting maybe 20 feet, maybe less, maybe 15 feet away from like Dennis Chambers, from Dave Weckl, incredible drummer, John McLaughlin. I've seen Chuck Mangione and his band. And you see these incredible musicians just right there. And how much
right there. They're just right there.
They're right there. And you're just literally seeing everything they're doing, you know, and being blown away. And also we paid, I think, $12 to see those guys, $12, $15 maybe at the most.
Yep.
You know, we would leave the Bottom Line sick. We would be so fit. We were so intense that we would leave and our throats, we weren't screaming. I don't know.
No.
But the intensity of what they were pulling out of us. But
you know, what was interesting about that is that we would go there and you would see, you would feel there's the way, like, okay, I could talk about the drummers, right? Especially like Weckl and Chambers. And these are some of the greatest drummers of all time that are still out there playing right now. You see them on tape is one thing, but when you're in front of them, the power that they project from those drums, even the musicians around them, and the musicians around them were so good that these guys could stop playing. The musicians will not lose time one millisecond.
No,
but the power that they generate when they play those drums is like bam, and you understand like why they are where they are, and why they're so. Why so many people love them, right?
Yeah.
And it's a whole nother level of, and then you leave. And of course, John, what does he do after we see, you know, somebody playing that day, he looks at me, he goes, damn, George, you suck.
He did that to me when we saw Clapton.
True. I did do that. Yes.
We saw Clapton, and actually it was Steve Gadd was on drums.
Yes, that's right.
And that was like another, another phenomenon with Steve Gadd. That could be a whole show in itself. So, all right. Well, we've covered two of our passionate artists that we have here, Rush and Stevie Ray Vaughan. You know, it's kind of sad in a way, because it almost just hit me right now that it's just not happening anymore with these artists.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting that we have these artists that just no longer are playing. Stevie, unfortunately, was taken from us, and Neil taken from us as well. So it's kind of interesting that those were the guys. At some point, we'll do a show with people that are alive and still playing, and then we'll talk about stuff that's happening now, you know, new stuff, you know, because there is great music happening right now, folks. Yeah, I mean, sure. don't be disappointed. Let me tell you guys something. This is a little rant here before we end off, but you know, don't be disappointed by top 40. Don't knock top 40. You know, a lot of people say, well, I don't listen to top 40, you know. Well, that's fine, and I can understand why, but just know that if you love music, if you love music, there is some incredible music happening right now, right here while we're on this show, right this second here on this Tuesday evening at 8:16 Central. There's incredible musicians making things happen right now. And all over the world, there's incredible music, you know. And for whatever reason, you know, they do make a living. They do tour. If you go out to some, you find an artist and you find, I was just talking about Drive-By Truckers, right?
Yeah.
A band that I found here on the artist country, alternative country rock station. And I went to go find them, and they have a huge following, you know. Yeah. Wilco has a huge following, stadiums stuff, you know, like big arenas and stuff. And they're making great music, you know, and you don't hear them on the top 40, you know. They don't belong on the top 40. They're too good to be on the top 40. You know, the top 40 is what's marketed to whatever, you know. It is what it is.
Yeah, so, no, and I just see, just to kind of piggyback on that, you're right. There is, you know, sometimes you have to look a little, you have to dig a little bit to find it. But there is great music out there. There's great songwriters who are writing amazing, you know, music and stuff. And I think if you dig a little bit, you will find it. And, you know, it's interesting that we're talking about that, because there was one rare clip of actually John's songwriting process that we have, and I'll show you guys.
Girl, I like your booty. Girl, I like your booty.
So, you know, there are amazing songwriters like
waiting
John.
For that.
So just don't forget that, okay?
You know, that I still think that has potential. I haven't finished the second verse from Girl Like Your Booty, but... Well, I don't know what I was talking about there. I must have been talking about...
You were actually talking about top 40.
Was I?
Yes. But don't knock top 40.
No. Because, hey, you know, once in... You might turn it on one day and it'll be like, John Henry Soto with Good Like Your Booty. Good Like Your Booty. Yeah. But there you have it, folks. We totally are appreciative of all of you. What was this here? And he got a booty like pow, pow, pow. That's right, Mr. Manuel. Thank you.
I love he's such a cool guy.
Yeah, he's a really cool guy. So yes, thank you very much, everybody. We appreciate it. I mean, if you're still watching here and you've been here since the beginning, I don't know, man. I think I'm in love with you. Yeah, you need help. That's one thing. But also, I do actually love you, and we really do appreciate you taking the time. And Sean says, love you too. Love you, Sean. All right on, man. So we do love you. We do appreciate you taking the time to spend with us. We know that there's a lot of distractions out there, and there's a lot of things that you can be doing. For you to spend some time with us here is truly, truly appreciated, and we really are grateful for you and for this opportunity to come to you with our show. Next week, we have a friend of the show's who's been on now. This will be, I think, his fourth time.
Oh, fourth, because he came on to our
year episode.
So our year-end show for a couple of minutes, yes.
Yeah, our anniversary show he came on. Oba Babatunde is going to be on the show.
Amazing actor. Oh, amazing actor, performer, entertainer.
Award-winning actor. He's also starting a new season of SWAT as well, which he's recording. He's doing a bunch of other stuff right now. It's really, really exciting to have him back on the show. So that's next Tuesday. Please tune in. We're going to have a lot of marketing on that as well. And we're excited to have Oba on the show. All right, folks. Thank you very much. Take care of yourselves. God bless. See you all next week, 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, artistblueprint.live. And until then, and as always, peace.